This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Fifth Risk, written by Michael Lewis, performed by Victor Bavine.
Prologue. Lost in Transition. Chris Christie noticed a piece in the New York Times. That's how it all started. The New Jersey governor had dropped out of the presidential race in February 2016 and thrown what support he had behind Donald Trump. In late April, he saw the article. It described meetings between representatives of the remaining candidates still in the race: Trump, John Kasich, Ted Cruz, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders, and the Obama White House. Anyone who still had any kind of shot at becoming president of the United States apparently needed to start preparing to run the federal government. The guy Trump sent to the meeting was, in Christie's estimation, comically underqualified. Christie called up Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, to ask why this critical job hadn't been handed to someone who actually knew something about government. "We don't have anyone," said Lewandowski. Christie volunteered himself for the job, head of the Donald Trump presidential transition team. "It's the next best thing to being president," he told friends. "You get to plan the presidency." He went to see Trump about it. Trump said he didn't want a presidential transition team. Why did anyone need to plan anything before he actually became president? "It's legally required," said Christie. Trump asked where the money was going to come from to pay for the transition team. Christie explained that Trump could either pay for it himself or take it out of campaign funds. Trump didn't want to pay for it himself. He didn't want to take it out of campaign funds either. But he agreed, grudgingly, that Christie should go ahead and raise a separate fund to pay for his transition team. "But not too much," he said. And so Christie set out to prepare for the unlikely event that Donald Trump would one day be elected president of the United States. Not everyone in Trump's campaign was happy to see him on the job. In June, Christie received a call from Trump advisor Paul Manafort. "The kid is paranoid about you," Manafort said. The kid was Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law. Back in 2005, when he was U.S. Attorney for the District of New Jersey, Christie had prosecuted and jailed Kushner's father, Charles, for tax fraud. Christie's investigation revealed, in the bargain, that Charles Kushner had hired a prostitute to seduce his own brother-in-law, whom he suspected of cooperating with Christie, videotaped the sexual encounter, and sent the tape to his sister. The Kushners apparently took their grudges seriously, and Christie sensed that Jared still harbored one against him. On the other hand, Trump, whom Christie considered almost a friend, couldn't have cared less. He'd invited Christie to his and Melania's wedding and then pressed him to attend his daughter, Ivanka, and Jared Kushner's wedding. "That'd be awkward," said Christie. "I'm paying for the wedding and I don't give a shit," said Donald. Christie viewed Jared as one of those people who thinks that because he's rich, he must also be smart. Still, he had a certain cunning about him, and Christie soon found himself reporting everything he did to prepare for a Trump administration to an executive committee. The committee consisted of Jared, Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, Paul Manafort, Steve Mnuchin, and Jeff Sessions. "I'm kind of like the church elder who double counts the collection plate every Sunday for the pastor," said Sessions, who appeared uncomfortable with the entire situation. The elder's job became more complicated in July 2016, when Trump was formally named the Republican nominee. The transition team now moved into an office in downtown Washington, D.C., and went looking for people to occupy the top 500 jobs in the federal government. They needed to fill all the cabinet positions, of course, but also a whole bunch of others that no one in the Trump campaign even knew existed. It's not obvious how you find the next Secretary of State, much less the next Secretary of Transportation. Never mind who should sit on the Board of Trustees of the Barry Goldwater Scholarship and Excellence in Education Foundation. By August, 130 people were showing up every day, and hundreds more working part-time at Trump Transition Headquarters, on the corner of 17th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. The transition team made lists of likely candidates for all 500 jobs, plus other lists of informed people to roll into the various federal agencies the day after the election, to be briefed on whatever the federal agencies were doing. They gathered the names for these lists by traveling the country and talking to people. Republicans who had served in government, Trump's closest advisors, recent occupants of the jobs that needed filling. Then they set about investigating any candidates for glaring flaws and embarrassing secrets and conflicts of interest. At the end of each week, Christy handed over binders with lists of names of people who might do the jobs well to Jared and Donald and Eric and the others. "They probed everything," says a senior Trump transition official. "Who was this person? Where did this person come from?" They only ever rejected one person, Paul Manafort's secretary. The first time Donald Trump paid attention to any of this was when he read about it in the newspaper. The story revealed that Trump's very own transition team, led by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, had raised several $1 million to pay the staff. The moment he saw it, Trump called Steve Bannon, the chief executive of his campaign, from his office on the 26th floor of Trump Tower, and told him to come immediately to his residence many floors above. Bannon stepped off the elevator to find the governor of New Jersey seated on a sofa, being hollered at. Trump was apoplectic, actually yelling, "You're stealing my money! You're stealing my fucking money! What the fuck is this?" Seeing Bannon, Trump turned on him and screamed, "Why are you letting him steal my fucking money?" Bannon and Christie together set out to explain to Trump federal law. Months before the election, the law said, the nominees of the two major parties were expected to prepare to take control of the government. The government supplied them with office space in downtown Washington, D.C., along with computers and trash cans and so on, but the campaigns paid their people. To which Trump replied, "Fuck the law. I don't give a fuck about the law. I want my fucking money." Bannon and Christie tried to explain that Trump couldn't have both his money and a transition. "Shut it down," said Trump. "Shut down the transition." Here Christie and Bannon parted ways. Neither thought it was a good idea to shut down the transition, but each had his own misgivings. Christie thought that Trump had little chance of running the government without a formal transition. Bannon wasn't so sure if Trump would ever get his mind around running the federal government. He just thought it would look bad if Trump didn't at least seem to prepare. Seeing that Trump wasn't listening to Christie, he said, "What do you think Morning Joe will say if you shut down your transition?" What Morning Joe would say, or at least what Bannon thought it would say, was that Trump was closing his presidential transition office because he didn't think he had any chance of being president. Trump stopped hollering. For the first time, he seemed actually to have listened. "That makes sense," he said. With that, Christie went back to preparing for a Trump administration. He tried to stay out of the news, but that proved difficult. From time to time, Trump would see something in the paper about Christie's fundraising and become upset all over again. The money people donated to his campaign, Trump considered effectively his own. He thought the planning and forethought pointless. At one point, he turned to Christie and said, "Chris, you and I are so smart that we can leave the victory party 2 hours early and do the transition ourselves." At that moment in American history, if you could somehow organize the entire population into a single line, all 350 million people, ordered not by height or weight or age, but by each citizen's interest in the federal government, and Donald Trump loitered somewhere near one end of it, Max Steyer would occupy the other. By the fall of 2016, Max Steyer might have been the American with the greatest understanding of how the U.S. government actually worked. Oddly, for an American of his age and status, he'd romanticized public service since he was a child. He'd gone through Yale in the mid-1980s and Stanford Law School in the early 1990s without ever being tempted by money or anything else. He thought the U.S. government was the single most important and most interesting institution in the history of the planet, and couldn't imagine doing anything but working to improve it. A few years out of law school, he'd met a financier named Sam Heyman, who was as disturbed as Max was by how uninterested, talented young people were in government work. Max persuaded Heyman to set aside $25 million for him so that he might create an organization to address the problem. Max soon realized that to attract talented young people to government service, he'd need to turn the government into a place talented young people wanted to work. He'd need to fix the United States government. Partnership for Public Service, as Max called his organization, was not nearly as dull as its name. It trained civil servants to be business managers. It brokered new relationships across the federal government. It surveyed the federal workforce to identify specific management failures and success. And it lobbied Congress to fix deep structural problems. It was Max Steyer who had persuaded Congress to pass the laws that made it so annoyingly difficult for Donald Trump to avoid preparing to be president. Anyway, from the point of view of a smart, talented person trying to decide whether to work for the U.S. government, the single most glaring defect was the absence of an upside. The jobs weren't well paid compared to their equivalents in the private sector, and the only time government employees were recognized was if they screwed up, in which case they often became the wrong kind of famous. In 2002, Max created an annual black tie, Oscars-like award ceremony to celebrate people who had done extraordinary things in government. Every year, the Sammies, as Max called them, in honor of his original patron, attracted a few more celebrities and a bit more media attention. And every year, the list of achievements was mind-blowing. A guy in the Energy Department, Fraser Lockhart, organized the first successful cleanup of a nuclear weapons factory in Rocky Flats, Colorado, and had brought it in 60 years early and $30 billion under budget. A woman at the Federal Trade Commission, Eileen Harrington, had built the Do Not Call Registry, which spared the entire country from trillions of irritating sales pitches. A National Institutes of Health researcher, Steven Rosenberg, had pioneered immunotherapy, which had successfully treated previously incurable cancers. There were hundreds of fantastically important success stories in the United States government. They just never got told. Max knew an astonishing number of them. He detected a pattern. A surprising number of the people responsible for them were first-generation Americans who had come from places without well-functioning governments. People who had lived without government were more likely to find meaning in it. On the other hand, people who had never experienced a collapsed state were slow to appreciate a state that had not yet collapsed. That was maybe Max's biggest challenge, explaining the value of this enterprise at the center of a democratic society to people who either took it for granted or imagined it as a pernicious force in their lives over which they had no control. He'd explain that the federal government provided service that the private sector couldn't or wouldn't. Medical care for veterans, air traffic control, national highways, food safety guidelines. He'd explain that the federal government was an engine of opportunity. Millions of American children, for instance, would have found it even harder than they did to make the most of their lives without the basic nutrition supplied by the federal government. When all else failed, he'd explain the many places the U.S. government stood between Americans and the things that might kill them. The basic role of government is to keep us safe, he'd say. The United States government employed 2 million people, 70% of them one way or another in national security. It managed a portfolio of risks that no private person or corporation was able to manage. Some of the risks were easy to imagine. A financial crisis, a hurricane, a terrorist attack. Most weren't. The risks say that some prescription drug proves to be both so addictive and so accessible that each year it kills more Americans than were killed in action by the peak of the Vietnam War. Many of the risks that fell into the government's lap felt so remote as to be unreal. That a cyber attack left half the country without electricity. Or that some airborne virus wiped out millions, or that economic inequality reached the point where it triggered a violent revolution. Maybe the least visible risks were of things not happening that, with better government, might have happened. A cure for cancer, for instance. Enter the presidential transition. A bad transition took this entire portfolio of catastrophic risks, the biggest portfolio of such risks ever managed by a single institution in the history of the world, and made all the bad things more likely to happen, and the good things less likely to happen. Even before Max created an organization to fix the federal government, the haphazard nature of presidential transitions drove him nuts. We have a legacy government that hasn't kept up with the world we live in, largely because of disruptions from bad transitions, he said. People don't understand that a bungled transition becomes a bungled presidency. The new people taking over the job of running the government were at best only partially informed, and often deeply suspicious of whatever happened to be going on before they arrived. By the time they fully grasped the problems they were dealing with, it was time to go. "It's Groundhog Day," said Max. "The new people come in and think that the previous administration and the civil service are lazy or stupid. Then they actually get to know the place they are managing. And when they leave, they say, 'This was a really hard job, and those are the best people I've ever worked with.' This happens over and over and over." Most of the big problems inside the U.S. government were of the practical management sort and had nothing to do with political ideology. A mundane but important example was how hard it was for any government agency to hire new people. Some agencies couldn't hire anyone without 60 different people signing off on him. The George W. Bush administration had begun to attack that particular mundane problem. The Obama administration, instead of running with the work done during the Bush years, had simply started all over again. Max Steyer's Partnership for Public Service had helped to push through three separate laws related to the transition. In 2010, Congress gave free office space and other resources to the nominees of the two major political parties right after the summer conventions. The reason campaigns didn't prepare is that they thought it would cost them politically. No one wanted to be seen measuring the drapes, said Max. The idea was to give the nominees of the major political parties cover to do what they should do. In 2011 to 2012, to enable the president to put people in jobs more quickly, Congress reduced the number of presidential appointments that required Senate confirmation from about 1,400 to roughly 1,200. Still over 1,000 too many in Max's view, but a start. Finally, in 2015, Congress required the sitting president to prepare in various ways to hand the government over to his or her successor. The person who had already taken the test was now required by law to help the person who may not have studied for it. As the 2016 presidential election approached, Max was about as hopeful as he'd ever been that the United States government would be handed from one leader to another with minimum stupidity. His partnership had worked with both the Clinton and the Trump campaigns. Their work was good, said Max. He was disappointed with Barack Obama in some ways. President Obama had been slow to engage with the federal workforce. He'd appointed some poor managers to run some agencies. The fiasco of the rollout of healthcare.gov was not an accident, but a byproduct of bad management. But Obama's preparations to hand over the government had been superb. The Obama administration had created what amounted to the best course ever on the inner workings of the most powerful institution on earth. What could go wrong? Chris Christie was sitting on a sofa beside Donald Trump when Pennsylvania was finally called. It was 1:35 in the morning. But that wasn't the only reason the feeling in the room was odd. Mike Pence went to kiss his wife, Karen, and she turned away from him. You got what you wanted, Mike, she said. Now leave me alone. She wouldn't so much as say hello to Trump. Trump himself just stared at the two without saying anything, like a man with a pair of twos whose bluff has been called. His campaign hadn't even bothered to prepare an acceptance speech. It wasn't hard to see why Trump hadn't seen the point in preparing to take over the federal government. Why study for a test you'll never need to take? Why take the risk of discovering you might at your very best be a C student? This was the real part of becoming president of the United States. And, Christie thought, it scared the crap out of the president-elect. Not long after the people on TV announced that Trump had won Pennsylvania, Jared Kushner grabbed Christie anxiously and said, We have to have a transition meeting tomorrow morning. Even before that meeting, Christie had made sure that Trump knew the protocol for his discussions with foreign leaders. The transition team had prepared a document to let him know how these were meant to go. The first few calls were easy. The very first was always with the Prime Minister of Great Britain. But two dozen calls in, you were talking to some kleptocrat and tiptoeing around sensitive security issues. Before any of the calls could be made, however, the President of Egypt called into the switchboard at Trump Tower and somehow got the operator to put him straight through to Trump. Trump was like, I love the Bangles, you know that song, Walk Like an Egyptian, recalled one of his advisors on the scene. That had been the first hint Christie had of trouble. He'd asked Jared Kushner what that was about, and Jared had simply said, Donald ran a very unconventional campaign, and he's not going to follow any of the protocols. The next hint that the transition might not go as planned came from Mike Pence, now, incredibly, Vice President-elect Mike Pence. Christie met with Pence the day after the election to discuss the previous lists of people who had been vetted for jobs. The meeting began with a prayer, followed by Pence's first, ominous question. Why isn't Puzder on the list for labor? Andrew Puzder, the head of CKE Restaurants, the holding company for Hardee's and Carl's Jr., wanted to be the Secretary of Labor. Christy explained that Puster's ex-wife had accused him of abuse, and his fast food restaurant employees had complained of mistreatment. Even if he was somehow the ideal candidate to become the next Secretary of Labor, he wouldn't survive his Senate confirmation hearings. Trump ignored the advice and nominated Puster. In the controversy that followed, Puster not only failed to be confirmed, but stepped down from his job at the fast food company. After meeting with Pence, Christie was scheduled to brief the Trump children and Jared and the other members of Trump's inner circle. He was surprised to find, suddenly included in this group, retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Flynn was a job seeker the transition team had found reasons to be extremely wary of. Now he wanted to be named Trump's National Security Advisor, which was maybe the most important job in the entire national security apparatus. The national security team inside the Trump transition, staffed with senior former military and intelligence officials, had thought that an especially bad idea. Flynn's name wasn't on the list. But here he was, in the meeting to decide who would do what in the Trump administration, and Ivanka was asking him which job he'd like to have. Before Christie could intercede, Steve Bannon grabbed him and asked to see him privately. Christie followed Bannon to his office impatiently. "Hey, this is going to have to be quick," said Christie. "It's really quick," said Bannon. "You're out." "Why?" asked Christie, stunned. "We're making a change." "Okay, what are we changing?"
"You."
"Why?" "It's really not important." The method of his execution was unsurprising. Trump always avoided firing people himself. The man who played Mr. You're Fired on TV avoided personal confrontation in real life. The surprise was that it was being done now, just when the work of the transition team was most critical. Only when Christie threatened to go down and tell reporters that Steve Bannon had fired him did Bannon concede. It was Jared. In the days after the election, the people in the building on 17th and Pennsylvania were meant to move to another building in downtown Washington, a kind of White House in waiting. They soon discovered that the lists that they had created of people to staff the Trump administration were not the lists that mattered. There was now this other list of people allowed into the new building, and most of their names weren't on it. People would show up to the new building and say, "Let me in," and the Secret Service would say, "Sorry, you're not on the list," said a civil servant who worked in the new building. It wasn't just Chris Christie who'd been fired. It was the entire transition team, though no one ever told them so directly. As Nancy Cook later reported in Politico, Bannon visited the transition headquarters a few days after he'd given Christie the news and made a show of tossing the work the people there had done for Donald Trump into the garbage can. Trump was going to handle the transition more or less by himself. Not even Steve Bannon thought this was a good idea. "I was fucking nervous as shit," Bannon later told friends. "I go, holy fuck, this guy, Trump, doesn't know anything, and he doesn't give a shit." Chapter 1. Tail Risk. On the morning after the election, November 9th, 2016, the people who ran the U.S. Department of Energy turned up in their offices and waited. They had cleared 30 desks and freed up 30 parking spaces. They didn't know exactly how many people they'd host that day, but whoever won the election would surely be sending a small army into the Department of Energy and to every other federal agency. The morning after he was elected president 8 years earlier, Barack Obama had sent between 30 and 40 people into the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy staff planned to deliver to Trump's people the same talks from the same 5-inch-thick, 3-ring binders with the Department of Energy seal on them that they would have given to the Clinton people. "Nothing had to be changed," said one former Department of Energy staffer. "They'd be done always with the intention that either party wins, nothing changes." By afternoon, the silence was deafening. "Day one, we're ready to go," says a former senior White House official. "Day two, it was, maybe they'll call us?" "Teams were going around. Have you heard from them?" recalls another staffer who had prepared for the transition. "Have you gotten anything?" "I haven't got anything." "The election happened," remembers Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, then deputy secretary of the DOE. "And he won. And then there was radio silence. We were prepared for the next day, and nothing happened." Across the federal government, the Trump people weren't anywhere to be found. The few places they did turn up, they appeared confused and unprepared. A small group attended a briefing at the State Department, for instance, only to learn that the briefings they needed to hear were classified. None of the Trump people had security clearance, or for that matter, any experience in foreign policy, and so they weren't allowed to receive an education. On his visits to the White House soon after the election, Jared Kushner expressed surprise that so much of its staff seemed to be leaving. "It was like he thought it was a corporate acquisition or something," says an Obama White House staffer. "He thought everyone just stayed." Even in normal times, the people who take over the United States government can be surprisingly ignorant about it. As a longtime career civil servant in the Department of Energy, who has watched four different administrations show up to try to run the place, put it, "You always have the issue of maybe they don't understand what the department does." To address that problem, a year before he left office, Barack Obama had instructed a lot of knowledgeable people across his administration, including 50 or so inside the DOE, to gather the knowledge that his successor would need in order to understand the government he or she was taking charge of. The Bush administration had done the same for Obama, and Obama had been grateful for their efforts. He told his staff that their goal should be to ensure an even smoother transfer of power than the Bush people had achieved. That had proved to be a huge undertaking. Thousands of people inside the federal government had spent the better part of a year drawing a vivid picture of it for the benefit of the new administration. The United States government might be the most complicated organization on the face of the earth. Its 2 million federal employees take orders from 4,000 political appointees. Dysfunction is baked into the structure of the thing. The subordinates know that their bosses will be replaced every 4 or 8 years, and that the direction of their enterprises might change overnight, with an election or a war or some other political event. Still, many of the problems our government grapples with aren't particularly ideological. And the Obama people tried to keep their political ideology out of the briefings. "You don't have to agree with our politics," as the former senior White House official put it. "You just have to understand how we got here. Zika, for instance, you might disagree with how we approached it. You don't have to agree, you just have to understand why we approached it that way. How to stop a virus, how to take a census, how to determine if some foreign country is seeking to obtain a nuclear weapon, or if North Korean missiles can reach Kansas City. These are enduring technical problems. The people appointed by a newly elected president to solve these problems have roughly 75 days to learn from their predecessors. After the inauguration, a lot of deeply knowledgeable people will scatter to the four winds and be forbidden by federal law from initiating any contact with their replacements. The period between the election and the inauguration has the feel of an AP chemistry class to which half the students have turned up late and are forced to scramble to grab the notes taken by the other half before the final. 2 weeks after the election, the Obama people inside the DOE read in the newspapers that Trump had created a small landing team. It was led by and mostly consisted of a man named Thomas Pyle, president of the American Energy Alliance, which, upon inspection, proved to be a Washington, D.C. propaganda machine funded with millions of dollars from ExxonMobil and Koch Industries. Pyle himself had served as a Koch Industries lobbyist and ran a business on the side writing editorials attacking the DOE's attempts to reduce the dependence of the American economy on carbon. Pyle said that his role on the landing team was voluntary and added that he could not disclose who appointed him due to a confidentiality agreement. The people running the DOE were by then seriously alarmed. "We first learned of Pyle's appointment on the Monday of Thanksgiving week," recalls Kevin Knobloch, then DOE chief of staff. "We sent word to him that the secretary and his deputy would meet with him as soon as possible. He said he would like that, but could not do it until after Thanksgiving." A month after the election, Pyle arrived for a meeting with Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, Deputy Secretary Sherwood Randall, and Knobloch. Moniz, a nuclear physicist who was then on leave from MIT and who had served as Deputy Secretary during the Clinton administration, is widely viewed, even by many Republicans, as understanding and loving the DOE better than any person on earth. Pyle appeared to have no interest in anything he had to say. "He did not seem motivated to spend a lot of time understanding the place," says Sherwood Randall. "He didn't bring a pencil or a piece of paper. He didn't ask questions. He spent an hour, that was it. He never asked to meet with us again." Afterward, Knobloch says. He suggested that Pyle visit one day each week until the inauguration, and that Pyle agreed to it, but then he never showed up. It's a head-scratcher, says Knobloch. It's a $30 billion a year organization with about 110,000 employees. Industrial sites across the country, very serious stuff. If you're going to run it, why wouldn't you want to know something about it? There was a reason Obama had appointed nuclear physicists to run the place. It, like the problems it grappled with, was technical and complicated. Moniz had helped lead the U.S. negotiations with Iran, precisely because he knew which parts of their nuclear energy program they must surrender if they were to be prevented from obtaining a nuclear weapon. For a decade before Knobloch joined the DOE, in June 2013, he had served as president of the Union of Concerned Scientists. I had worked closely with DOE throughout my career, he says. I thought I knew and understood the agency. But when I came in, I thought, holy cow. Deputy Secretary Elizabeth Sherwood Randall has spent her 30-year career working on reducing the world's supply of weapons of mass destruction. She led the U.S. mission to remove chemical weapons from Syria. But like everyone else who came to work at the DOE, she'd grown accustomed to no one knowing what the department actually did. When she'd called home, back in 2013, to tell them that President Obama had nominated her to be second in command of the place, her mother said, "Well, darling, I have no idea what the Department of Energy does, but you've always had a lot of energy, so I'm sure you'll be perfect for the role." The Trump administration had no clearer idea what she did with her day than her mother. And yet, according to Sherwood Randall, they were certain they didn't need to hear anything she had to say before they took over her job. Pyle eventually sent over a list of 74 questions he wanted answers to. His list addressed some of the subjects covered in the briefing materials, but also a few not. "Can you provide a list of all Department of Energy employees or contractors who have attended any interagency working group on the social cost of carbon meetings? Can you provide a list of department employees or contractors who attended any of the Conference of the Parties under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in the last 5 years?" That, in a nutshell, was the spirit of the Trump enterprise. "It reminded me of McCarthyism," says Sherwood Randall. It says a great deal about the mindset of career civil servants that the DOE employee in charge of overseeing the transition set out to answer even the most offensive questions. Her attitude, like the attitude of the permanent staff, was, "We are meant to serve our elected masters, however odious they might be." When the questions got leaked to the press, she was really upset, says the former DOE staffer. The only reason that the DOE did not serve up the names of people who had educated themselves about climate change and thus exposed themselves to the wrath of the new administration was that the old administration was still in charge. "We aren't answering these questions," Secretary Moniz had said simply. After Pyle's list of questions wound up on Bloomberg News, the Trump administration disavowed them, but a signal had been sent. "We don't want you to help us understand. We want to find out who you are and punish you." Pyle vanished from the scene. According to a former Obama official, he was replaced by a handful of young ideologues who called themselves the Beachhead Team. "They mainly ran around the building insulting people," says a former Obama official. "There was a mentality that everything that government does is stupid and bad, and the people in it are stupid and bad," says another. "They demanded to know the names and salaries of the 20 highest paid people in the national science labs overseen by the DOE. They'd eventually delete the contact list with the email addresses of all DOE-funded scientists, apparently to make it more difficult for them to communicate with one another." "These people were insane," says the former DOE staffer. "They weren't prepared. They didn't know what they were doing." "We had tried desperately to prepare them," said Tarek Shaw, chief of staff of the DOE's $6 billion basic science program. "But that required them to show up and bring qualified people. But they didn't. They didn't even ask for an introductory briefing, like, what do you do?" The Obama people did what they could to preserve the institution's understanding of itself. "We were prepared for them to start wiping out documents," said Shaw. "So we prepared a public website to transfer the stuff onto it, if needed." The one concrete action the Trump transition team took before Inauguration Day was to attempt to clear the DOE and other federal agencies of people appointed by Obama. But there was actually a long history of even the appointees of one administration hanging around to help the new appointees of the next. The man who had served as the Department of Energy's chief financial officer during the Bush administration, for instance, stayed a year and a half into the Obama administration, simply because he had a detailed understanding of the money end of things that was hard to replicate quickly. The CFO of the department at the end of the Obama administration was a mild-mannered civil servant type named Joe Hizier. He had no particular political identity and was widely thought to have done a good job, and so he half expected a call from the Trump people asking him to stay on, just to keep the money side of things running smoothly. The call never came. No one even let him know his services were no longer required. Not knowing what else to do, but without anyone to replace him, the CFO of a $30 billion operation just up and left. This was a loss. A lunch or two with a chief financial officer might have alerted the new administration to some of the terrifying risks they were leaving essentially unmanaged. Roughly half of the DOE's annual $30 billion budget is spent on maintaining and guarding our nuclear arsenal. $2 billion of that goes to hunting down weapons-grade plutonium and uranium at loose in the world so that it doesn't fall into the hands of terrorists. In 8 years alone, 2010 to 2018, the DOE's National Nuclear Security Administration collected enough material to make 160 nuclear bombs. The department trains every international atomic energy inspector. If nuclear power plants around the world are not producing weapons-grade material on the sly by reprocessing spent fuel rods and recovering plutonium, it's because of these people. The DOE also supplies radiation detection equipment to enable other countries to detect bomb material making its way across national borders. To maintain the U.S. nuclear arsenal, it conducts endless expensive experiments on tiny amounts of nuclear material to try to understand what is happening to plutonium when it fissions, which, amazingly, no one really does. To study the process, it is funding what promises to be the next generation of supercomputers, which will in turn lead God knows where. The Trump people didn't seem to grasp how much more than just energy the Department of Energy was about. They weren't totally oblivious to the nuclear arsenal, but even the nuclear arsenal didn't provoke in them much curiosity. They were just looking for dirt, basically, said one of the people who briefed the beachhead team on national security issues. What is the Obama administration not letting you do to keep the country safe? The briefers were at pains to explain an especially sensitive aspect of national security. The United States no longer tests its nuclear weapons. Instead, it relies on physicists at three of the national labs, Los Alamos, Livermore, and Sandia, to simulate explosions using old and decaying nuclear materials. This is not a trivial exercise, and to do it, we rely entirely on scientists who go to work at the national labs because the national labs are exciting places to work. They then wind up getting interested in the weapons program. That is, because maintaining the nuclear arsenal was just a byproduct of the world's biggest science project, which also did things like investigating the origins of the universe. Our weapons scientists didn't start out as weapons scientists, says Madeline Creedon, who was second in command of the nuclear weapons wing of the DOE, and who briefed the incoming administration, briefly. They didn't understand that. The one question they asked was, wouldn't you want the guy who grew up wanting to be a weapon scientist? Well, actually, no, you wouldn't. In the run-up to the Trump inauguration, the man inside the DOE in charge of the nuclear weapons program, Frank Klotz was his name, was required to submit his resignation, as were the department's 137 other political appointees. Frank Klotz was a retired three-star Air Force lieutenant general with a Ph.D. in politics from Oxford. The keeper of the nation's nuclear secrets had boxed up most of his books and memorabilia, just like everyone else, and was on his way out before anyone had apparently given the first thought to who might replace him. It was only after Secretary Moniz called U.S. senators to alert them to the disturbing vacancy, and the senators phoned Trump Tower sounding alarmed, that the Trump people called General Klotz and, on the day before Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th President of the United States, asked him to bring back the stuff he had taken home and move back into his office. Aside from him, the people with the most intimate knowledge of the problems and the possibilities of the DOE walked out the door. It was early June 2017 when I walked through the same door to see what was going on. The DOE makes its home in a long rectangular cinder block-like building propped up on concrete stilts just off the National Mall. It's a jarring sight, as if someone had punched out a skyscraper and it never got back on its feet. It's relentlessly ugly, in the way the swamps around Newark Airport are ugly. So ugly that its ugliness bends back around into a sneaky kind of beauty. It will make an excellent ruin. Inside, the place feels like a lab experiment to determine just how little aesthetic stimulation human beings can endure. The endless hallways are floored with white linoleum and almost insistently devoid of personality. Like a hospital without the stretchers, as one employee put it. But this place is at once desolate and urgent. People still work here, doing stuff that, if left undone, might result in unimaginable death and destruction. By the time I arrived in Washington, the first eighth of Trump's first term was nearly complete, and his administration was still largely missing. He hadn't nominated anyone to serve as head of the Patent Office, for instance, or to run the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. There was no Trump candidate to head the Transportation Security Administration, and no one to run the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The 2020 national census will be a massive undertaking for which there is not a moment to lose, and yet there's no Trump appointee in place to run it. The actual government has not really taken over, said Max Steyer. It's kindergarten soccer. Everyone is on the ball. No one is at their positions. But I doubt Trump sees the reality. Everywhere he goes, everything is going to be hunky-dory and nice. No one gives him the bad news. At this point in their administrations, Obama and Bush had nominated their top 10 people at the DOE and installed most of them in their offices. Trump had nominated 3 people and installed just one, former Texas Governor Rick Perry. Perry is, of course, responsible for one of the DOE's most famous moments, when, in a 2011 presidential debate, he said he intended to eliminate 3 entire departments of the federal government. Asked to list them, he named Commerce, Education, and then hit a wall. The third agency of government I would do away with, Education, Commerce, and let's see. As his eyes bored a hole in his lectern, his mind drew a blank. I can't, the third one. I can't. Sorry. Oops. The third department Perry wanted to get rid of, he later recalled, was the Department of Energy. In his confirmation hearings to run the department, Perry confessed that when he called for its elimination, he hadn't actually known what the Department of Energy did, and he now regretted having said that it didn't do anything worth doing. The question on the minds of the people who currently work at the department, does he know what it does now? In his hearings, Perry made a show of having educated himself. He said how useful it was to be briefed by former Secretary Ernest Moniz. But when I asked someone familiar with those briefings how many hours Perry had spent with Moniz, he laughed and said, "That's the wrong unit of account." With the nuclear physicist who understood the DOE perhaps better than anyone else on Earth, Perry had spent minutes, not hours. He has no personal interest in understanding what we do in effecting change, a DOE staffer told me in June 2017. He's never been briefed on a program, not a single one, which to me is shocking. Since Perry was confirmed, his role has been ceremonial and bizarre. He pops up in distant lands and tweets in praise of this or that DOE program, while his masters inside the White House create budgets to eliminate those very programs. His sporadic public communications have had in them something of a shell-shocked grandmother trying to preside over a pleasant family Thanksgiving dinner, while pretending that her blind drunk husband isn't standing naked on the dining room table, waving the carving knife over his head. Meanwhile, inside the DOE building, people claiming to be from the Trump administration appeared willy-nilly, unannounced, and unintroduced to the career people. There's a mysterious kind of chain from the Trump loyalists who have shown up inside DOE to the White House, said a career civil servant. That's how decisions like the budget seem to get made, not by Perry. The woman who ran the Obama department's Energy Policy Analysis Unit received a call from DOE staff telling her that her office was now occupied by Eric Trump's brother-in-law. Why? No one knew. Yes, you can notice the difference, said one young career civil servant, in response to the obvious question. There's a lack of professionalism. They're not very polite. Maybe they've never worked in an office or government setting. It's not hostility so much as a real sense of concern with sharing information with career employees. Because of that lack of communication, nothing is being done. All policy questions remain unanswered. The DOE has a program to provide low-interest loans to companies to encourage risky corporate innovation in alternative energy and energy efficiency. The program became infamous when one of its borrowers, the solar energy company Solyndra, was unable to repay its loan. But as a whole, since its inception in 2009, the program has turned a profit. And it has been demonstrably effective. It lent money to Tesla to build its factory in Fremont, California, when the private sector would not, for instance. Every Tesla you see on the road came from a facility financed by the DOE. Its loans to early-stage solar energy companies launched the industry. There are now 35 viable utility-scale, privately funded solar companies, up from zero a decade ago. And yet today, the program sits frozen. There's no direction what to do with the applications, says the young career civil servant. Are we shutting the program down? There's no staff, just me. People keep bugging me for direction. It's got to the point I don't care if you tell me to tear the program down. Just tell me what you want to do so I can do it intelligently. Another permanent employee in another wing of the DOE says, the biggest change is the grinding to a halt of any proactive work. There's very little work happening. There's a lot of confusion about what our mission was going to be. For a majority of the workforce, it's been demoralizing. Over and over again, I was asked by people who worked inside the DOE not to use their names or identify them in any way for fear of reprisal. People are heading for the doors, says Tarek Shah. And that's really sad and destructive. The best and the brightest are the ones being targeted. They will leave fastest, because they will get the best job offers. There might be no time in the history of the country when it was so interesting to know what was going on inside these bland federal office buildings, because there has been no time when those things might be done ineptly, or not done at all. But if you want to know how the DOE works, the problems it manages, the fears that keep its employees awake at night, the things it does you just sort of assume will continue being done, there's no real point in being inside the DOE. Anyone who wants a blunt, open assessment of the risks inherent in the United States government now has to leave it to find it. By the time I reached John McWilliams's kitchen table in Quogue, Long Island, I knew about as much about the DOE as he had when he'd started there back in 2013. McWilliams had spent a lot of his life pursuing and obtaining a place in the world that he actually hadn't wanted. In the early 1980s, after graduating from Stanford and Harvard Law School, he took a coveted job at a prestigious New York law firm. Seeing that the action was not in law but in finance, he jumped to Goldman Sachs where, as an investment banker specializing in the energy sector, he rose quickly. 6 years into his career as a Goldman banker, he realized he didn't want to be a banker any more than he'd wanted to be a lawyer. He was actually seriously interested in the energy sector. He could see it was on the cusp of a great transformation, but he didn't particularly care for Wall Street or the effect it was having on him. One day I looked in the mirror shaving, and there was this haggard face, and I said, "But for the money, would you do this?" What he wanted, he thought, was to be a writer. But when he shared his secret ambition with his Goldman boss, his boss just looked at him pityingly and said, "John, you have to have talent to write a book." He wasn't rich at that point. He had a few hundred grand to his name. But at the age of 35, he quit his Goldman job and set out to be a novelist. For the next year, he wrote the novel he had imagined, The Fire Dream, he called it, and despite the indifference of the publishing industry, he began another one. But while the first story had come naturally to him, the second one felt forced. He sensed that he probably didn't want to be a writer much more than he had wanted to be a lawyer or an investment banker. "The hardest part was admitting to myself in my black blue jeans that I missed my old life," he said. He set out to raise money for a fund that would invest in energy companies, at which point an editor from Random House called and said he couldn't get the Fire Dream out of his head and regretted having rejected it. McWilliams sensed absurdity in his situation. He'd already abandoned his literary ambition. "I can't be a novelist trying to raise an equity fund," he said. So he stuck his novel back in the drawer and became a founding partner of the Beacon Group, a private investment firm. And also within that group was co-head of a Beacon fund that specifically invested in the energy field. 7 years later, he and his partners sold the Beacon Group to J.P. Morgan Chase for $500 million. Along the way, he'd come to know a nuclear physicist, Ernie Moniz, who asked him to join an MIT task force to study the future of nuclear power. In early 2013, when Moniz was named Energy Secretary, he called Nick Williams and asked him to come to Washington with him. "I recruited him because my view was you should collect talent," says Moniz, "and it's unusual to have someone willing to work in government who has been so deeply involved in private sector investment." "I always wanted to serve," says McWilliams. "It sounds corny, but that's it." Still, he was an odd fit. He'd never worked in government and had no political ambition. He thought of himself as a problem solver and a deal guy. "I've been investing in energy since the mid-1980s and never once went to the DOE and didn't think I needed to," he said. "I was just wrong." In the beginning, he spent much of his time bewildered. "Everything was acronyms," he said. "I understood 20 to 30% of what people were talking about." He set out aggressively to educate himself, pulling people from every nook and cranny and making them explain until he understood what they did. "It took me about a year to understand it all," he said, which inadvertently raises the question of how long it would take someone who wasn't so curious. Anyway, he figured out soon enough that the DOE, though created in the late 1970s, largely in response to the Arab oil embargo, had very little to do with oil, and had a history that went back much further than the 1970s. It contained a collection of programs and offices without a clear organizing principle. About half its budget in 2016 went to maintaining the nuclear arsenal and protecting Americans from nuclear threats. It sent teams with equipment to big public events, the Super Bowl, for instance, to measure the radiation levels in hopes of detecting a dirty bomb before it exploded. "They really were doing things to, like, keep New York safe," said McWilliams. "These are not hypothetical things. These are actual risks." A quarter of the budget went to cleaning up all the unholy world historic mess left behind by the manufacture of nuclear weapons. The last quarter of the budget went into a rattlebag of programs aimed at shaping Americans' access to and use of energy. There were reasons these things had been shoved together. Nuclear power was a source of energy, and so it made sense, sort of, for the department in charge of nuclear power also to have responsibility for the weapons-grade nuclear materials, just as it sort of made sense for whoever was in charge of making weapons-grade uranium and plutonium to be responsible for cleaning up their own mess. But the best argument for shoving together the Manhattan Project and nuclear waste disposal and clean energy research was that underpinning all of it was big science, the sort of scientific research that requires multi-billion dollar particle accelerators. The DOE ran the 17 national labs, Brookhaven, the Fermi National Accelerator Lab, Oak Ridge, the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab, and so on. "The Office of Science in DOE is not the Office of Science for DOE," said McWilliams. "It's the Office of Science for all science in America." I realized pretty quickly that it was the place where you could work on the two biggest risks to human existence, nuclear weapons and climate change. He was surprised, a little shocked even, by the caliber of civil servants working on these problems. This idea that government is full of these bureaucrats who are overpaid and not doing anything. "I'm sure that in the bowels of some of these places you could find people like that," he said. "But the people I got to work with were so impressive. It's a military-like culture." Federal employees tended to be risk-averse, the sort of people who carry an umbrella around all day when there's a 40% chance of rain. But then sometimes they weren't. In 2009, amid protests that helped touch off Libya's bloody civil war 2 years later, a young woman who worked for him went into the country with Russian security forces and removed highly enriched uranium. The brain power of those still willing to enter public service also surprised him. There were physicists everywhere, guys whose ties don't match their suits, passive nerds, guys who build bridges. Ernie Moniz had wanted McWilliams to evaluate the DOE's financial risks. After all, that's what he'd done for most of his career. But also, as Moniz put it, to go beyond financial risks to all the other risks that weren't being properly evaluated. To that end, Moniz eventually created a position for McWilliams that had never existed, Chief Risk Officer. As the DOE's first ever Chief Risk Officer, McWilliams had access to everything that went on inside of it and a bird's eye view of it all. With a very complex mission and 115,000 people spread out across the country, shit happens every day, said McWilliams. Take the project to carve football field-length caverns inside New Mexico's salt beds to store radioactive waste at the WIPP, Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, facility. The waste would go into barrels, and the barrels would go into the caverns, where the salt would eventually entomb them. The contents of the barrels were volatile and so needed to be seasoned with, believe it or not, kitty litter. In 2014, according to a former DOE official, a federal contractor in Los Alamos, having been told to pack the barrels with inorganic kitty litter, had scribbled down anorganic kitty litter. The barrel with organic kitty litter in it had burst and spread waste inside the cavern. The site was closed for 3 years, significantly backing up nuclear waste disposal in the United States and costing $500 million to clean, while the contractor claimed the company was merely following procedures given to it by Los Alamos. The list of things that might go wrong inside the DOE was endless. The driver of a heavily armed unit assigned to move plutonium around the country was pulled over on the job for drunk driving. An 82-year-old nun cut through the perimeter fence of a facility in Tennessee that housed weapons-grade nuclear material. A medical facility ordered a speck of plutonium for research, and a weapons lab clerk misplaced a decimal point and FedExed the researchers a chunk of the stuff so big it should have been under armed guard, whereupon horrified medical researchers tried to FedEx it back. At DOE, even the regular scheduled meetings started with, "You're not going to believe this," says former Chief of Staff Kevin Knobloch. In his 4 years on the job, McWilliams had come to understand the DOE's biggest risks, the way a corporate risk officer might understand the risks inside a company, and had cataloged them for the next administration. "My team prepared its own books. They were never given to anybody. I never had a chance to sit with the Trump people and tell them what we're doing, even for a day. And I'd have done it for weeks. I think this was a sad thing. There are things you want to know that would keep you up at night, and I never talked to anyone about them." It's been 5 months since he left government service, and I'm the first person to ask him what he knows. Still, I think it is important, as I pull my chair into his kitchen table, to conduct the briefing in the spirit the Trump people might have approached it, just to see how he could have helped even those who thought they didn't need his help. I assume the tone and manner befitting a self-important, mistrustful person newly arrived from some right-wing think tank. And so I wave my hand over his thick briefing books and say, "Just give me the top 5 risks I need to worry about right away. Start at the top." And right away we have a problem. An accident with nuclear weapons is at the top of his list, and it is difficult to discuss that topic with someone who doesn't have security clearance. "But the Trump people didn't have it either," I point out, "so he'll just need to work around my handicap." "I have to be careful here," he says. He wants to make a big point. The DOE has the job of ensuring that nuclear weapons are not lost or stolen, or at the slightest risk of exploding when they should not. "It's a thing Rick Perry should worry about every day," he says. "Are you telling me that there have been scares?" He thinks a moment. "They've never had a weapon that has been lost," he says carefully. "Weapons have fallen off planes." He pauses again. "I would encourage you to spend an hour reading about broken arrows." Broken arrow is a military term of art for a nuclear accident that doesn't lead to a nuclear war. McWilliams has had to learn all about these. Now he tells me about an incident that occurred back in 1961 and was largely declassified in 2013, just as he began his stint at DOE. A pair of 4-megaton hydrogen bombs, each more than 250 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima, broke off a damaged B-52 over North Carolina. One of the bombs disintegrated upon impact, but the other floated down beneath its parachute and armed itself. It was later found in a field outside Goldsboro, North Carolina, with 3 of its 4 safety mechanisms tripped or rendered ineffective by the plane's breakup. Had the 4th switch flipped, a vast section of eastern North Carolina would have been destroyed, and nuclear fallout might have descended on Washington, D.C. and New York City. "The reason it's worth thinking about this," says McWilliams, "is the reason that bomb didn't go off was because of all the safety devices on the bombs designed by what is now DOE. The Department of Energy, he continues, spends a lot of time and money trying to make bombs less likely to explode when they are not meant to explode. A lot of the work happens in a drab building with thick concrete walls at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in Northern California, one of the three nuclear weapons research sites funded and supervised by the DOE.